Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. This is the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here at KHOI to talk about what's cooking in Central Iowa. All sorts of things. Food, farming, advice, opinions, recipes.
Oh, and we got lots of news stories today.
Oh, yes, Dee. The Donalana Kitchen News Department. We'd like to remind ourselves that news affects us, and it affects what happens on our plates.
Yes. Yeah. It's usually related to food and farming.
Yeah, everything
our
is.
Our news, anyway.
Yeah, our news is. Good. This last weekend, beautiful weekend, Maximum Ames was in Ames. All kinds of music happened last week. And this weekend, there was the Iowa State University of Iowa game on Saturday, and KHOI was there. If you want to learn more about football, and I have tuned this in, and I'm learning more about Cyclone football, KHOI is sharing time and partnering with the Gridiron Club for a pregame show in front of every home game. So find out more about Cyclones and everything. KHOI is all about building community through communications. And I'm finding out about the community that calls itself Cyclone Nation.
And didn't you say that KHOI did an interview of the Cy mascot?
Oh, yes,
and
yeah.
A few other notable people?
And the notable people like cheerleaders and important people that bring that together. And I hear there's lots of things like tailgating going on. If you know about tailgating, contact us. It's something that I have never done. So tailgating, I do believe that includes food.
I imagine it to be a picnic.
Yeah.
On the back of the tailgate, right?
Sounds good. Sounds good. And lots of people gather.
Truck.
Lots of people gather. That's good. I have a recipe to share. We're coming to the end of tomato season.
The shortest tomato season I have ever seen.
It was a challenging year. Oh, there's still tomatoes at farmers market. You can still get homegrown tomatoes. No problem. My tomatoes have gone belly up. So I've been drying. I've been oven roasting them. I have been putting them by, so to speak, because it's the tail end for me. So as your tomatoes get fewer and fewer and far between.
And perhaps a little ugly.
Yeah. There's ways to use them up. I was given this recipe by friend Brenna Dixon, who is a good cook and a local writer. She lectures at ISU. And this is called a tomato cobbler recipe. It's called tomato cobbler with blue cheese biscuits. Now, this...
It's savory, not sweet.
Right. You'd think cobbler would be sweet, but it's not. It's tomatoes roasted in the oven and has these wonderful blue cheese biscuits on the top. I'm going to post this recipe, or actually the link to this recipe, on our website.
Oh, right. It's inspired by Martha Stewart and the Clinton Street Bakery Cookbook.
Right. There's a website called Joy the Baker, and she gave us this recipe, or you can find it on her website, and I'll put the link on our website. I want to thank Brenna Dixon for this and mention that Brenna Dixon was on our show ages ago, and she read the sexiest poem about pineapple that I have ever heard. And so, if you
sexy
would like,
pineapple.
Oh, she has a love affair with pineapple, and she wrote a lovely poem, and you can find that on the, believe it or not, it's archived on the Donalana Kitchen website. You can go to KHOI, go to the talk shows, go to Donalana Kitchen, and pull down archives. And this is the archive for
April
24th, 2014. It's a show called Cornbread and Poetry, and you'll find a very nice love poem to pineapple.
And you'll find that on our archive page, we have over 100 shows already.
Can you believe it? Who would have thought that there'd be that much to talk about?
And we haven't finished yet.
We haven't. We haven't. And also, there's a whole section of just our recipes. Most recently, and they should be up soon as our webmaster gets to it, there will be the all important Aunt Tiny's dirt cake recipe will be up there soon. And this link to the tomato cobbler with blue cheese biscuits, it's really good. It's really
and do we good. Already have Sharon Rasmussen's ground cherry pie up?
Yes. There's Grandma Kniff's ground cherry pie. That's there. A chocolate cake by Beth Kemp. Beth's chocolate frosting and Beth's red wine chocolate cake. And thanks to Beth, I was given, as part of a birthday present, I had that cake, and it was pretty
darn
good.
It
was really good.
And then Lana made the ground cherry pie last night, which was really sweet.
Yes. This is the season for ground cherries, so I'd never made ground cherry pie before. And there's all sorts of stuff. There's a pork liver pate from Donna. There's Grandma Bumgardner's plum pudding. There's all kinds of
stuff. That's my grandmother.
Yeah, yeah. And Donna has a recipe for honey butters. There's leek and apple salad. There's Swedish black currant schnapps. There's all kinds of things on there. So, to go to our website.
That's black currant leaf schnapps.
Leaf schnapps. Schnapps. And we didn't write it down in Swedish because it was way too long. So, to go to that, you can go to khoifm.org and find our webpage and visit us there. And if you want to contact us, let us know what you think about this show. Send us an idea for a recipe. Send us an idea for a show. We're about what happens in Central Iowa here. You can contact us at khoiradio@gmail.com and kind of make a little note, Donalana Kitchen or DLK, and we'll get that. We'll get that. Good. We have in our studio today a special guest.
Dum da 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 da. Taylor Brorby, who is a North Dakota native, an expert on fracking, teaches and studies at ISU in the Creative Writing and the Environment program, and is my roommate. Taylor, give us a Bakken pipeline update.
So far, what we're seeing is proceedings are happening for the Bakken pipeline.
They're proceeding.
Mm-hmm. Both sides are preparing their testimonies about what this pipeline means, what it could mean, what it does mean for the future of Iowa. And the scheduling for the hearing, it's similar to a public trial that happens for about 1 to 2 weeks, which will be happening in Boone. It hasn't formally been scheduled yet.
Does it happen in a courthouse?
So it happens, to my understanding, in a courthouse.
We have a courthouse in Boone? Is Boone the county seat? Oh, it's the county seat of
Boone County.
Boone is the county seat of Boone County.
And so the rationale for having the public hearing, it's not formally called a trial, but in Boone, is the midway point of this pipeline.
In the middle of the state,
through
yes.
Iowa. So that'll probably be scheduled sometime in November or December. But right now, the IUB is reviewing public—
Iowa Utility Board.
Right, which is a triumvirate of three people.
Who decide, right?
Deciders. They're the deciders of this pipeline. They're currently— right now, reviewing public comments on the pipeline, whether people are pro or against the pipeline, taking that into consideration. But this hearing that will happen will bring in a plethora of different people, both from the oil industry to talk about the pros or supposed pros of pipelines. And then there will be other people that testify, myself, actually.
And you are testifying as?
As a resident of Western North Dakota, someone who goes up to—
has borne the brunt of fracking.
That's right, and lets us know what fracking looks like on the front lines and what this type of model would mean.
For example, I have to give a little shout-out to Taylor. He has a new book coming out that he has edited called—
Fracture.
And I have been reading it, and I learned from reading this book that the pumping station, which we are going to have in Ames, is apparently extremely loud. Now, they never explained that. It's like parking several jet airliners permanently in your backyard.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it takes so much force and energy to really.
I mean, you think pumping station, it never occurs to you that this is going to be a serious noise polluter, among other things.
Well, it takes a lot of pressure and force because Iowa, if this pipeline is built, will basically be transporting 25 million gallons of Bakken oil a day. And you need a lot of power and a lot of energy to keep that oil moving.
Yeah, those are mind-numbing numbers. So
yeah. And, I mean, it takes a lot of gears and mechanics to have a pumping station
running. Especially since it's not downhill.
Right, exactly. So you're right, Donna. That sounds similar to having a jet engine nearby to people who live in the area.
And it's not just taking off and landing. It's there all the time.
That's right. This oil would be flowing 24 hours a day, transporting across, you know, 8 major watersheds of Iowa.
So tell us who else is going to be giving testimony.
Yeah, outside of myself and the oil industry, one of the larger names who is actually going to be flying in from New York City to be giving testimony is James Hansen, who works at the NASA Goddard Institute, affiliated with Columbia. For listeners who don't know, James Hansen was the first scientist to testify before Congress in the late 80s to raise awareness around climate change. And even other researchers in the sciences will call him an alarmist, but he's an alarmist whose predictions also always come true. So it's a rather big deal that
he's also an Iowa native.
He is. Yep. He got his PhD at the University of Iowa and has just done incredible work in terms of predictions about climate and climate change.
So he's going to show up and give a testimony.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. It should heighten the level of conversation around this pipeline, I'd imagine.
Is there going to be time for citizen input, or is this just a formal presentation?
So to my understanding is the time for citizens' opinions has passed, the public commenting period on the pipeline. So what will happen is the IUB will have reviewed these comments, and then this hearing will take place. And then from that point, it could be as quick as a month or less that the IUB would make a ruling on whether or not this pipeline would be built in Iowa. So the hearing is the final stage before the actual decision is made.
I've been aware that there are people contesting the pipeline on grounds of eminent domain. Is that part of this process, or they're still being challenged?
So to my understanding is that people are still challenging the right of this pipeline to go through their property.
And that's on an individual basis.
Yeah, not as a collective whole. Yeah. You know, there have been meetings by several hundreds of farmers whose land this crosses to see what options are available. But, of course, how this is presented is made people feel like there isn't an option and that you better take it while the asking price is good and sign your land over that the pipeline be built.
But didn't that turn out to be not true in Nebraska? Didn't they challenge the use of eminent domain for a private corporation?
Right. So in Nebraska, they've had success with holding up the Keystone XL pipeline in the courts to say that the argument is that it's not a public necessity and a public good. In the Gas Act, which really gained traction under the Bush and Cheney administration, there became the infamous Halliburton loophole, which basically puts into the act that there's a public necessity and convenience clause, which means we've structured our society as such that it's a public necessity and it's convenient to have oil and things like natural gas for our modern way of life. And so what that does is it gives these large oil corporations a leg up to say, well, this is a public necessity. It's a public need. However, that is different from what eminent domain was originally intended for. Eminent domain was you know, first intended that you would take a private good and move it into the public commons. So,
like for building a road, if you
right, like the interstate system. I mean, farmers had to lose part of their had to give up or were compensated, I guess, for their land and the loss of that land. It was viewed as an important transportation system.
But then the farmers and the rest of us use that facility.
Right.
It's a public facility.
Right, exactly. And the government takes place in this. But now how public, how eminent domain can be used is you're moving a private good, someone's private land, to a private corporation, a for-profit private corporation.
Only for the corporation.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, there's no real conversation or critique in the public discourse about eminent domain and how it relates to the public good when pipelines leak. You know, when like the pipeline leaked in Glendive, Montana this year, which leaked benzene into 6,000 people's drinking water, a known cancer-causing agent. That is what the oil from the Bakken will be carrying through Iowa, you know, as it crosses the Missouri River, the Mississippi, the Des Moines River, eight major watersheds.
Well, have we reached a point as a society where we can actually, in a court of law, suggest that enlarging fossil fuel delivery systems is no longer a public good because of climate change?
Well, we've been seeing there have been cases out in the world of people, actually middle schoolers, have done this. A group of them are suing the U.S. government.
Oh, in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
I read about that. They're
right.
Suing the U.S. government for not protecting their future.
Right, for not taking adequate measures on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
We've also seen, and this would be a great thing for farmers to do, there have been some ingenious people out there who have copywritten their property as public art, that they've done installations on their land. And then it's an infringement on that piece of art, that area is literally copywritten.
Oh, for goodness. Well, that's a good try. Yeah. I like that. That's good. Well, I've seen some artistic statements. There are signs.
Crop circles?
Semi-trailer that has the words "no more eminent domain" or "we're against eminent domain" or whatever is illegal.
Route 35. I've seen it. Yeah,
that's a piece of art there, and I'm sure there's other signs.
Maybe we should just go paint some little designs on it or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I also wanted to note as a little news issue. Carolyn Raffensperger told me that yesterday the state of Minnesota was required to go kind of back to the drawing board in their legal process for pipelines because they had not done a proper environmental protection impact statement.
That's right. And part of these hearings, too, other people that will be involved are people like wildlife biologists to talk about what's the impact to biological diversity and native ecosystems to Iowa? And as a result, what does that compromise from the installation of a pipeline?
And are there going to be people speaking about the frequency of spills and the fact that, I mean, I went to some of the original hearings and I don't think that we're adequately prepared, our first responders, God bless them, are not prepared for dealing with things on this scale.
Well, and part
Nor
of it,
are they compensated to do it
right.
either.
Well, that will be part of my testimony, is that North Dakota has reported spills. You know, this isn't compulsory. A company just does it if it wants to, lets the state government know there's been a spill. But in the past roughly decade of the Bakken oil boom, there's been over 10,000 oil, salt water, and chemical spills. Now, not all
in the state of North Dakota.
In the state of North Dakota, which impacts Iowa, because all of these spills empty into the Missouri River watershed. Now, these, of course, aren't all pipeline spills, but pipeline spills are the biggest, because it's not simply that when a pipeline leaks, you shut the valve off and the oil stops flowing. It depends what segment it's in. And usually that release will be several hundred, if not thousands, of barrels of oil. And the rate at which this pipeline will be transporting oil and the amount of oil, the amount it can leak within minutes is staggering. You know, think of
how big across? What's the diameter of a pipe?
This one's 30 inches.
30 inches, and it's flowing how fast?
I don't know miles per hour, but it's 25 million gallons of oil per day.
Well, I mean, 30 inches is like a hula hoop size or something, you know? That must carry a lot of things. So a little hole that they take 20 or 30 minutes, and that would be a conservative estimate,
right,
I suppose, to shut off. Because we did ask how far apart the valves were. I mean, how many valves are we getting in this state?
So valves usually are every, you know, usually they should be about every half mile, but they can be as much as every 3 miles away, which gives you a sizable amount of oil to work with. And it depends on if the leak is actually found. Historically in North Dakota, there have been leaks that have gone on for several hours or days because they simply think there's an air bubble in the pipe that's working its way through when there's a loss of pressure, and then...
Oh, that's how the computer monitors it.
Right, because these are automatically monitored. It's not that each valve is manned for 24 hours a day. It's relying on a computer to make sure that the oil is flowing as it should.
Well, Taylor, this is, for me, it's a little frightening. I certainly hope we don't have a pipeline in our backyard. But you will keep us updated.
Yes.
Okay, and I have another piece of news. Okay. We reported on this a few weeks ago that the World Health Organization had declared that glyphosate, which is Roundup Ready, which is used widely around here on both corn and soybeans. That is the herbicide that the genetically modified corn and soybeans are grown to be able to tolerate this particular herbicide. So a few weeks ago, the World Health Organization declared that it was a probable carcinogen. This week, the state of California has declared that glyphosate is a carcinogen. So I'm getting one more anxiety here. So I actually had a little email exchange with Irv Klaus, who's kind of our he's been on the show before. He's our water guru, kind of. And he wasn't able to come and tell us about this, but he did say that the Ames Aquifer aquifers are fairly shallow. He said they're about 110 feet deep. He said, however, that the river bottoms and the sediment do a reasonable job of cleaning them. But his opinion was that our water should certainly be tested for glyphosate. So I suppose my next step will be, I think I'll have to go to the city and ask them if, in fact, we're testing for it. And then there are a few other people like Science, Health, and the Environmental Network, which is Carolyn Raffensperger's organization. I think I'll consult with them about what the appropriate limits are. Obviously, we have a lot of it around here. And I would say it's safe to say that even though California has declared it as a carcinogen, it will be a while before Iowa does, because, of course, Monsanto says, oh, no, that's simply not true. But then given, do I want to trust a government organization versus someone who is selling a product? I would say there has to be, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. So we're going to keep pursuing this. We do know that, you know, there's probably a lot of glyphosate in the air around us, certainly in the land around us, and we'll check about the water.
Yes, we're talking about the common good here, which seems to be
under threat
from something that is maybe not our common good. We've been talking about the Bakken pipeline, and we've been talking about, or Donna just mentioned, the state of glyphosate. Lots of things to wonder about. I want to take time to mention, you're listening to KHOI 89.1 FM. Tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. And Donald on a Kitchen is brought to you by many fine folk. We're all volunteers here, and we have support from other fine folks, too.
Yes, support for the Donald on a Kitchen comes from Wheatsfield Cooperative, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Welcome back. This is the Donald on a Kitchen. That was a little music by a group called Kaeltori, a nice Celtic CD that I found at the bottom of a pile of stuff. One should get out one CD.
What kind of instrument was that?
It's a combination of hammer, dulcimer, Celtic harp, and other stuff too, I think. But that's mainly... Yeah, there's a Celtic harp in there, and they do other things,
Well,
too.
We need a little levity with the show we're doing today.
We do. There's lots of things to think about. We're talking about the common good, and we have a special guest today.
Common good, and we're talking about lots of battles that we're fighting here for the environment. So, Taylor Broerby, who is an expert from North Dakota and can tell us how fracking ruined his childhood playground. And he's here in Iowa to help us not let that happen to us.
Yep.
And Taylor has a new book. Tell us about the book, Taylor.
So this is the nation's first anthology of creative writing on the topic of hydraulic fracturing, on this extractive process that happens in places like Texas, Oklahoma, North Dakota, Pennsylvania for natural gas. No one's in the artistic world really been assembling writing around this yet. So I thought, well, it might be good to get a choir of people to talk about this. We've been having journalists who cover it. There are some photographers who have been doing work around this issue. But there's not sort of a go-to stop of writing for it. It's particularly many people's voices. This anthology started about a year ago, almost exactly, with Ice Cube Press, which is a local Iowa press based over near Iowa City. The publisher is Steve Sempkin. And we were just talking about my time in Western North Dakota and our love of different writers. And I had just in passing said, well, no one has done a book of hydraulic fracturing and poems about that, or, you know, essays or short stories.
This is not your normal topic of poetry.
No.
But art always talks about what's important. And this is it. This is right. This is good.
And one of the things that I've found, too, is we have 51 authors in this anthology. I sort of have been joking this is everybody's doorstop or tool of self-defense.
No, it's about 500 pages.
It's about 500 pages.
My. I'm halfway through the proof copy. I am learning a lot.
And that's great for me to hear because it's also, art should also be educating us a little bit, too, about what's happening. But I think, these poems, these short stories, and then essays.
Right. There's some great fiction. Yeah. And there's a lot of very well-known writers in it. Can you reel off a few names?
Yeah. So some readers might know, like, Bill McKibben is in it or Linda Hogan, who's a wonderful poet.
Rick Bass
is in it from Montana.
Our own Fred Kirschman and Carolyn Raffensperger.
Right, from Ames, and Deborah Marquardt from Ames, too. And we have people like Alison Hawthorne Deming as well. We just have both established and emerging writers, which it's great to bring all those voices onto the page together.
And there's some poetry in it, actually. It's quite delightful.
Yeah.
Well, in a difficult sort of way.
In a heavy topic sort of way. But I think it gets at something a little bit different than our news media does.
Absolutely.
It means you have to listen to someone's story.
There's some good history about the oil industry and fracking and technical and scientific things that are written in ways that are easy to understand.
Yeah, and that's the hope of the anthology is it's not written for technical experts, that, someone who shops at the co-op or goes to the Iowa State Fair can pick up this anthology and can learn something about fracking.
It's too bad we can't have the Iowa Utility Board read it.
Exactly, yeah.
So when is the publication date?
So the book will be available through Ice Cube Press starting December 15th of this year, and then the book will formally hit bookstores on Valentine's Day of 2016. So February will be when it starts appearing in bookstores.
Okay, and we'll certainly have Taylor back on air to do a reading for us.
I'd be happy to.
And the name of the anthology again?
It's Fracture.
Fracture. So look for that coming up. Remember, make a nice Christmas present or a Valentine's Day present.
Oh, you could order it in time for Christmas from Ice Cube Press.
That's right.
Do you know their website?
It is icecubepress.com.
We could handle that. Okay.
Can do that.
All right, we have some more environmental news. Okay, this one was actually very interesting, and I must say it's about time. The headline in the Ames Tribune reads, "Court revokes approval of insecticides citing, quote, unquote, alarming decline in bees." So this was in San Francisco, and the Federal Court of Appeals Thursday, they used the word vacated. They vacated the Environmental Protection Agency's assessment of this pesticide called sulfoxaflor, which is probably used widely around Ames. I noticed even that there was a listing, well, not only is it in the Ames paper, but it was also on the, it's sold under the brand names Closer. Oh, boy, Closer. And Transform. Sulfoxaflor is an insecticide aimed at piercing and sucking insects, such as aphids and lichens, that attack a variety of crops, such as cotton. We don't worry about it. But it also is used on soybeans. It was registered for use in California, and now it has been deregulated, and they have to kind of the court said that the EPA recognized the potential for the hazards to bees, but they decided that the risks would be reduced by rules limiting applications. This decision was made, quote, without any meaningful study. So the suit was brought about by several of the large national, bee and pollinator associations. And I would say this is a major environmental victory, kind of calling the EPA on the carpet for not doing what it's supposed to do. I know in Europe 2 years ago, all of this stuff was banned. So now we're going to have a rethink on that in our country. Hopefully we haven't killed off all the bees in the process.
We've been hearing about problems with our bee colonies. People have been talking about this for quite a while. And finally, there's actually a national ruling that a pesticide is actually not so good for bees, and we're doing something about it. Things
well,
are looking up, folks.
The beekeepers asked for justice, and by golly, they pursued it all the way through the courts, and it should make some notable changes.
We always think about honeybees, but there's lots of other bees and pollinators out here that this sort of stuff affects too, as I understand. And we have to remember, we share the planet with a lot of other beings, and those beings, as in bees, beings help us, feed
us. Some of them
are they feed
us. Quite tiny.
Yeah, they feed us. They pollinate the food that we eat. Remember that. And I must remember that, too. I had a unfortunate run-in with a yellow jacket nest a week and a half ago, and as it was being rather painful, I did remember they do actually belong here. They really do. They're not being mean. They're just didn't like my jar of Windex that I was using.
Intrusive.
I was intrusive. Don't ever wash your kitchen window. They just did not like my being there. So here's to the bees. Here's to the bees. You're listening to KHOI. Support us. Contact us. This is community radio. We'll be listening to another bit of music here. Again, from the band Keltori. This is a wonderful air, or just a lovely tune called Far Away.
To lift the mood a bit.
Yeah, Far Away. Back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about the common good and some things that our society does that is not necessarily for the common good, and we're questioning that sort of thing.
And some people think that Donna and Lana, who are the food ladies, should not be talking about these things. But
we are anyway.
Well, I think this all applies to food and agriculture, and it's just all one big basket of folly sometimes.
Yes, it's all one big basket called life, and we're part of it. Yes, we are. There's something else that's part of it, and I notice in this time of year, crows and ravens are starting to gather and go over the cornfields and make all kinds of noise. I've always been fascinated by crows and ravens. I ran across a book called.
Do you know the difference? Can you tell the difference?
Yeah, there is. There's a difference. Ravens are a lot bigger. Crows are around here. Ravens
so mostly we just have crows.
Yeah, we do. Actually, I got a book called In the Company of Crows and Ravens by John M. Marsluff and Tony Angel. And I got that at the Ames Public Library. Everything you wanted to know about crows, and actually there are many, many, many species of crows, all sorts of different things. Ravens are the biggest, and it goes
down. There's wonderful books about living with crows and how clever they are.
They are extremely, extremely clever. This is a lovely book because John M. Marsluff is a writer, and Tony Angel, A-N-G-E-L-L, is a illustrator. And so this book is full of a lot of really nice drawings of birds. So I flip through and look at all the pictures first. And actually, it gets kind of technical, but you can learn all kinds of things in this book. And among everything else, I ran across this real fine poem about crows. It's kind of from the crow's point of view. They're amazingly intelligent creatures, and they've probably got a lot to teach us. And here's from thinking about crows. They are with us all the time, and think about them for a bit here. This is from a poet named Doug Anderson. A poem about crows. Crows hunch in the trees to gossip about God and his inexorable experimenting, about deer guts and fish so stupid you could sell them air, and how out in the desert there's a dog called Coyote, with their mind, but no wings. Crow with Iroquois hair. Crow with a wisecrack for everybody. Crow with his beak thrust through a bun, the paper still clinging. Crow in a midnight blue suit, standing in front of a judge. Your Honor, I didn't kill him. I just ate him. And I wasn't impressed. There you go. It's nice to know that we share the planet with something as lovely as a crow. That was a poem by Doug Anderson.
Well, I wanted to include one more sort of bit of news. The National Geographic, which we all grew up with as our sort of, the pictorial guide to nature and the ways of all kinds of interesting aspects of civilization, this week was purchased by Rupert Murdoch and 20th Century Fox News. So, there's an article written on Grist, and the title is Meet the New National Geographic and Weep. Now, part of the problem is that Rupert Murdoch is sort of self-identified as a climate skeptic. So, having one of our premier science publications, at least a science publication that really speaks to the public.
It's a popular science.
It really explains a lot to us non-scientists, and we've all relied on it for 100 and some years, I think. So there's a writer named Mallory Ortberg at something called The Toast, and she created a mock new copy of National Geographic, and the headlines are, Water! There's plenty of it everywhere. One of the sub-stories is animals. Do we really need so many of them? And then she suggested further articles might be, there are ice cubes in my drink, so how can global warming exist? Another one would be, the weather. Why it's been so normal lately? Or the last one, the 10 most Reagan-esque animals. So I just want us all, as we read the National Geographic, as we have done for many, 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 many years, to note carefully, not to put your rose-colored glasses on, and to peruse it a little more carefully, because the ownership, and hence quite likely the editorializations, will be making a shift. So be aware.
Right. Everybody has a point of view. And National Geographic, coming to you by the same folks that bring you Fox News, it could get really interesting out there, folks. In other words, question authority. Question everything.
And now we have to question the National Geographic.
Oh, wouldn't you know? Wouldn't you know? Well, some things that are coming up or things that are actually growing. And I've been harvesting lately. Like I mentioned before, you can still find tomatoes and lots of stuff at farmers market. Do come to visit a farmers market in your area.
Yes, while it's still green before it turns golden and then barren.
Yes, there's just all kinds of people willing to sell you good things and good food out there. Tomatoes are still tomatoes. My tomatoes have kind of gone belly up.
Well, but we are getting into eggplant.
Oh,
very
good.
We still have okra. I saw more and more peppers that were not just green at the market. And I have to say, we are having a lovely apple year.
Oh, apples. It's time. It's time for apples. Well, I want to mention peppers. Some other growers have mentioned that some of their hot peppers just aren't hot this year. You kind of need hot weather to bring out the heat in hot peppers. And I have a variety that I was kind of disappointed in this year.
Not only are they not hot, they're hardly red.
Right. They're just kind of hanging in there, not doing much. But patience. We may get some couple weeks of
Who knows? We should start a raffle pretty soon on the first frost date.
Oh, we could. We could. I wondered if anybody else had pepper problems or end-of-the-season problems, you can contact us at khoiradio@gmail.com and let us know your garden gossip. We'd like to hear what's going on. Another thing that is doing well, and I stumbled across mushrooms this time of year.
Oh, she had some delicious oyster mushrooms. Ooh.
Well, I didn't find them. My husband found them. I cooked them. Oyster mushrooms. Came across a whole big stash of oyster mushrooms. And they were darn good. I dried a lot of them. They dry absolutely beautifully. Actually, even in this sunny weather, you could probably just dry them out in the sun. But I like to put them in a food dryer. Also, about a week and a half ago, I came across a smaller chicken of the woods. And actually, that is a tastier mushroom as far as I'm concerned. It was lovely. We had a little bit of that. That was a smaller thing.
You don't get as – they're not as prolific, are they?
Well, at least it wasn't. I found it on a tree stump, and it was kind of off by itself.
I forgot to bring your shiso. Lana's going to make an experiment. I have a bumper crop of shiso, both the red, which is also known as perilla, and the Korean and the regular Japanese shiso. So Lana is going to try making shiso jelly.
Why not? You can make jelly out of everything. So we'll see how that works. It'll probably end up looking pretty pink, and we'll see what it tastes like.
So, tastes like shiso.
We'll see. Yes, yes.
Now, there are two apple things going on. The berry patch this weekend, which is out near Nevada. I'm sure you can find there. Just Google berry patch. They are having Saturday morning pick your own or their farm tour or whatever. If you have not ever been out there, it is gorgeous. And it's a wonderful place to take the children to pick apples. And they have multiple varieties. So that's Judy and Dean Henry are having that at the Berry Patch Farm. That's this coming Saturday.
Right. And Saturday the 26th. There will be a cider pressing at another farm. Now, this farm is north and west of Ames, Mustard Seed Organic Farm. You can find more information at mustardseedfarm.org. You can talk to Alice and Nate out there. They're having a cider pressing.
They have an old, all wooden, fully operational cider press. So if you bring your own apples and your own jugs, you can go home with cider. Now, it's a pretty messy but really fun process. And it's really family friendly, too. So I would encourage you, if you have an apple tree, that would be a great time to pick.
Or if your neighbor has an apple tree, that they would be absolutely only too glad for you to pick up.
Absolutely.
Yes.
There's often too many apple trees around town that nobody picks.
Apple cider pressing is something that is best done in a big group. Like Donna said, it's a messy process, but it's fun. And do remember, if you bring apples, also bring clean bottles to put them in. That's quite a problem. You always end up with more juice than you ever thought. So bring bottles.
It tastes unbelievably good just fresh out of the press. And then, of course, you can age it if you'd like.
Oh, you could. You could.
One could. And that is Saturday, the 26th of September. 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. And to get the directions, look up mustardseedfarm.org.
It would be a fine, fine way
Lana
to spend.
Lana has some apple trees. Maybe she's going.
Right. I'd rather take my apples to someplace else, like Mustard Seed Farm, and have them done there. We can do it at our place, too. But like I said, it's a mess.
And it's fun to do in a group.
Yellow Jackets love cider. They'll show up in quantities. And, oh, yeah, okay, that's fine.
Okay, Lana's had her Yellow Jacket experience for the year, and it wasn't fun.
No, enough of that. We haven't mentioned PFI Field Days, Practical Farmers of Iowa Field Days that are happening. There's things coming up today. There is a hybrid corn for food and feed field day at in Lucerne, and there's one coming up September 19th about robotic milking for improved dairy production. Oh, I wonder what the cows feel about that. Oh, dear. That's
well, as long Wilton. As it's not robotic cows.
At Blue Knoll Farm, yes, lots of things. Vermicomposting, there's a one coming up. Vermicomposting and cover crops for vegetables in West Branch, Iowa, at the Scattergood Friends School.
That's another lovely place to go.
Oh, yes, yes.
They have a swimming hole there. Take your suit.
Good, good. And there's a one on energy and economics of an organic dairy. That's coming up. That's in Decorah. All sorts of good things coming up. To find out more about Practical Farmers and these field days, they're everyone's welcome. So you can find out where your food comes from. Go to practicalfarmers.org.
Yeah, they're all – a field day is always a farmer inviting people to come. And he shows some special thing that he's been working on and discovered and how it works on his farm. And it's all kinds of things from, you know, pork to fruit trees to cover crops. And there are, I don't know how many there were, maybe at least 100 or something.
Oh, certainly.
So we're close to the end of the season, but they do go through into the fall. So it's a lovely chance to learn a lot more about agriculture if you're not a farmer. And, of course, it's lots of fun. I love hanging out with farmers, of course. It's farmers getting together and sharing ideas.
Practical Farmers of Iowa. Look them up. Yes. Find out where your food comes from. We're talking about the common good, what's good for us today, and we've heard about the Bakken pipeline. That's still up for discussion as to whether that's the common good. And there's other things that we're worrying about, the bees, which are affected by what some folks thought was a common good, a pesticide.
Yes, and we're worrying about the young people reading the National Geographic.
Oh, the common good there, the common good. We'll go out with some more music. Speaking of apples, the name of this CD is called Silver Apples of the Moon.
Oh, and we will have further reporting after I visit the city offices and talk to the water people and see what we can learn about if our water is in fact tested for glyphosate.
Important things all. We had a special guest, Taylor Broadby, talking about his new book, Fracture. More about that in the future, too. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI. KHOIFM.org. Visit us on the Donna Lana Kitchen website. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. This is a tune called, actually it's a whole medley of polskas played gently by the band Kale Torrey from their album Silver Apples of the Moon. Eat good food and enjoy life. Thank you.